I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, books with a beach theme. Joining us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And author Peter Abrahams, who pens the Chet and Bernie series.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Peter. All right, we're going to start right off with Beach Boy Marcel Proust.
Well, you know, and I understand that not everyone may realize that Proust is the Beach Boy, but that's why I'm here. That's why the librarian
and
is
you
in
are
the room.
Such a Proust fan. You'll bring him into any conversation.
I do what I can. But, you know, I had actually forgotten until I started prepping for this show what a beautiful job he does in describing life at the beach. And a big part of his second volume in the very long set of novels that he has written is the second one is called In the Shadow of Young Girls in Flower by Proust. And in this volume, sort of mid-volume, he goes to the seaside with his grandmother. He goes to this ocean village of Balbec, and he discovers the world that is a seaside village and what that means, including he discovers one of the key scenes in this part of the novel is when he discovers this gang of girls on the beach. And in that gang of girls is a young girl named Albertine, and Albertine becomes very significant to Proust. But let me just read a couple sentences of this to give you an idea of how beautifully he describes what it is to be to go somewhere else for the summer, which happens to be the beach. He writes, "For my grandmother, however, it was a matter of principle that when you go on vacation, you sever relations with people. You do not go to the seaside to meet people. There is plenty of time for that in Paris. They just make you squander in trite civilities the invaluable time you should be spending exclusively in the open air, communing with the waves." So you see, he gets the general gist of what one should be doing when one goes to the beach. Here's a section where he's actually spotted these girls on the beach, which, you know, what do young men do on the beach? And
is he wearing a Speedo, do you think, at the time? I don't want to go that direction at all.
I suspect not. Here he writes, "By myself, I was standing about outside the Grand Hotel," which is where he stays with his grandmother, "waiting for the moment when I would go in to sit with my grandmother. And there, still far away along the esplanade, where they made a strange mass of moving colors, I saw five or six young girls as different in their appearance and ways from all the other people one was used to seeing in Balbec as the odd gaggle of seagulls that turns up out of the blue to strut along the beach, the stragglers flapping their wings to catch up with the leaders in a procession that seems as obscure in its purpose to the bathers whom they seem not to see as it is clear to their bird minds." So you also get a great little description of the seagulls on the beach. He's got a terrific description of sunset. This sunset description, which I will not read the whole thing because it goes on for pages, but talks about the beautiful colors. And he writes, "Then the days grew shorter, and when I went to my room, the violet sky, which seemed to have been branded by the rigid, geometrical, fleeting, flashing iron of the sun, as though in representation of some miraculous sign or mystical apparition, hung down over the sea at the juncture of the horizon like a religious canvas above a high altar, while the different parts of the sunset exhibited in the glass doors of the low mahogany bookcases running around the walls, and which I mentally compared to the marvelous painting from which they had been detached, were like the different scenes with which an old master once decorated a shrine for a religious house, now divided into separate panels for display in a museum." And it goes on and on and on, because that's what Proust does. He goes on and on and on. But if you are a landscape painter out there and you've never read his description about, or a seascape painter, he goes on for pages and pages describing this one painting that is full of all the colors and mystery of the sea and the sunset. So, you know, good for painters and good for people who want another look at the seaside and what the seaside means to people.
Right. starting out with a bang there, Peter. How do you follow that?
I mean, we're going way, way down, right? Intellectual level right away. Although that part about the girls on the beach, I wonder if Brian Wilson had read that before he wrote California Girls, whether he would have had an interesting mix. All right, way, way down. I'm going to start with Sandcastles Made Simple by Lucinda. She has a nickname, Sandy Feet. Wieranga. So, I don't know, if you've been to the beach, you must have seen that, I don't know, what is it, maybe 2% of the people are industrious. Like, they're there to work. And they build, you know, sandcastles. I remember when I was a kid, my brother and my sister and I, we built this huge, not very good looking, just a kind of Romanesque pile after the barbarians had destroyed it kind of thing, but huge. And I said to my dad, wow, you know, tomorrow, I can't wait to see it tomorrow. And he said, it'll be flat. Smooth. And we went and it was flat and smooth. And I think that's the appeal. You, the more elaborate, and it makes the evanescent part of it all the more appealing in a kind of way. Anyway, in this book, Sandcastles Made Simple, everything you'd want to know. For example, you need lots of water.
I was going to say, does it to give you the right ratio of sand?
Yes, all the ratio. So that way, you can't build above the high tide line, really, unless you bring in all your water. So it's going to have to be something that comes and goes. You learn about hand stacking, the scoop, the plop, and the jiggle. It's all in here, and they're great pictures. And here's, I mean, here you see this enormous castle, what, maybe twice the height of the people.
Wow. Yes, that's
so
huge.
She is actually a professional sandcastle guru, I guess you'd say.
And I mean, they have contests and stuff at some beaches of these, you know.
That's right.
Oh, there
absolutely.
Are. Yeah, yes. She goes from one to another, and she's not the only one. So right. If you're in that 2% that wants to build while you're at the beach, sandcastles made simple.
All right.
Well, and I have to say that the sandcastles, my aunt and my brother used to make these huge, just pyramid sort of things, but with then turn them into marble places where the marble could roll down the sandcastle,
right.
So that it all became about starting the marble.
Thing, yeah.
Yes, the marble at the top and letting it roll down. But this business of the tide, that could be very, very upsetting from time
to
time.
Take a photo.
As long as you started far enough away so you weren't halfway building when the tide,
comes
arrived.
In.
Oh, that's key too. She goes into that.
Yeah. Oh, good.
All right, Jill, what's your next book?
I have another classic, but this is a classic much more down to earth than the Proust, which is called Gift from the Sea, and this was written by Anne Morrow Lindbergh. And I first read this book when I first came to Falmouth many years ago now, and I don't know where. In fact, I was staying in a B&B, and they had this book in the B&B. So I, you know, being a reader, I picked it up and read it. This that I have in my hand now is actually the 50th anniversary edition. Originally, it was published in 1955. The 50th anniversary edition came out in 2005. And what it is a very short book where she is meditating. She goes to the beach and she is meditating on the water and the beach and being alone. There's a lot in here about relationships between women and men and how what women need and what men need. Again, this was 1955, and to me, she seems incredibly progressive for having been writing this in 1955, and the importance of getting away from your partner and how great it is to return once you've been away. And it starts with a description of the beach. And she writes, "The beach is not the place to work, to read, write, or think. I should have remembered that from other years. Too warm, too damp, too soft for any real mental discipline or sharp flights of spirit. One never learns. Hopefully, one carries down the faded straw bag, lumpy with books, clean paper, long overdue unanswered letters, freshly sharpened pencils, lists, and good intentions. The books remain unread, the pencils break their points, and the pads rest smooth and unblemished as the cloudless sky. No reading, no writing, no thoughts even, at least not at first." And she takes a different shell. Each chapter is about a different shell, and she sort of describes her life in terms of each shell. One of the interesting things is that if you have already read this, because there are many, many people who have read this and love this book and her meditations on being alone at the beach and not with a huge crowd, She also has her letters and journals have been published. And I think it's really interesting that she's talking about being alone on the beach in 1948, which is in her diary. And she writes, "I lay under the stars alone. I made my breakfast alone. Alone, I watched the gulls at the end of the pier dip and wheel and soar and dive for the broken bread I threw them. A morning's work and then a late lunch alone on the beach. And it seemed to me that no longer united to my own species, I was nearer to others in their aloneness." And she goes on to talk about how, again, sort of the thoughtfulness. But what also is interesting about this particular collection of diary entries is that when she gets to the part where she's actually published this book, Gift from the Sea, which was enormously popular in 1955, right from the get-go, it was popular. She's sort of like, oh, well, I didn't expect it to be so popular. And I'm not sure I still stand by these things that I wrote and how difficult that was for her, and which you read about in the diaries in the book. So it's, you can look at it from one side, which is the side of the author who has written this book that means so much to her. And then you see the other side in the letters and diaries about what it was like once the book became a huge success.
That was then, this is now.
Exactly, exactly.
Peter, what's your next book?
Well, also something, we're on very different planes today, Jill.
And you were worried about bringing the same books,
yeah,
right?
That isn't going to happen. So I don't know. This next book is, I guess, we'll address this to anyone in chat, in the Chatham down Cape area right now, who maybe is out there having a little swim. Maybe maybe they've, you know, finished building, they're taking a break on sandcastle construction, and they're hot, and they go out for a little swim, and they see a fin break the surface, you know, and they think, gee, I wonder what that is. Well, I have this book, Sharks of the World. It's the Princeton Field Guide. And if they just flick to plate 30, they'll see that it's a great white, you know, and it's a good idea to not be in the water. The plates here are outstanding, and in the back there's all information on every shark in the world. So you, just from that dorsal fin alone, you'd have a pretty good chance, because the plates are so good, of identifying that, yes, it is a great white, and maybe I should get, and then of course you turn to go back to the beach, and there's another fin right there between you and the beach. But so this is, but you, with these, you won't be, you'll be able to identify. And so they'll, you'll see some of them will be a shark that isn't particularly dangerous, and you can stay in the water.
Basking shark. You look at that fin, you go, if you're not in Chatham, perhaps, maybe you're swimming off of Falmouth, and you go, oh, a fin. Oh, it's a basking shark. I can stay in the water.
Yeah.
Because they're plant eaters. They don't
eat. Or they're nurse sharks aren't, but we don't have them. But, you know, there are many sharks that really aren't particularly dangerous. But it's probably a good idea if you see a great white not to be swimming.
To get out of the water quickly.
Yeah.
Don't swim near the seals.
Right. Well, they don't, can't tell.
Yeah, I know. That's because they don't mean to get you.
We
right.
look very seal-like.
Right.
And there's nothing mean about it. They're just, you know, just the way you'd maybe take a tiny little bite of like a carrot just to taste the dip or something. I mean, that's all they're doing. The trouble is, that's the end of your life.
Yeah. That's
the scale of the creature.
We're talking about books with a beach theme. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books with a beach theme with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to make a suggestion for our list. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill.
Now, not everything I brought was serious and weighty. I actually also have brought some fun things. And one of them is a book about sea glass. Now, of course, people love to collect sea glass along the beach. It used to be much easier to do.
I was going to say, you don't find it so easily
anymore.
Now.
That's right, because plastic sort of took over the bottle making, because a lot of what you were finding would be pieces of bottles, especially, I think, beer bottles that were thrown off the side of boats, perhaps. But there is some great books about sea glass and what you are actually picking up when you pick up some sea glass. This book I have is called Pure Sea Glass, Discovering Nature's Vanishing Gems by Richard Lamott. And it is a really delightful sort of overview of all the different kinds of things you might be picking up on the beach. So it's about the history of the sand. It also has a section on locating sea glass, the history of the glass, the sort of common colors of glass, flat glass, bottles, appraising the rarity of what you have found. And so, for example, in the bottles and containers, they have a study. It begins, the study of American-made glass bottles from the mid-1700s to early 1900s provides a fascinating journey through U.S. history. So you're really getting bottle history as well as anything. It has a section on bitters bottles, which would cover 1840 to 1920 to give you an idea of how old your bottle might be. Gin bottles from 1800 to 1900, apparently. Gin was in a great glass bottle. And it does, of course, talk about the vanishing sea glass, which is, again, because a lot of glass isn't being used to make things anymore. I actually have had calls at the library for people trying to find out where there used to be a glassmaking factory in Falmouth. Hmm. And people wanting to know where that was because they were hoping to find the really old bits of glass. And it was actually quite near the ocean. So whether they actually have found any of these pieces, I don't know.
This is a great book, but not, I mean, the photography in it's also fabulous.
That's right. Yeah. He's got great images of the items that the actual glass would have come from. So bottles and pitchers and all kinds of things that are made out of glass, tableware, utility glass, all these things could be found along the beach. So that's Pure Sea Glass by Richard Lamott. And then for you crafters out there, we go from the... And one of the things that I will say is that what has happened over the past few years is you will now see prepackaged sea glass. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that these sea glass crafts are really for the people who have piles and piles. Mind you, my mother collected sea glass and I have I have bucketfuls of sea glass from when she was collecting. But for those of you that don't have bucketfuls of sea glass, they're also now like manufacturing fake sea glass. But it looks really different.
Yeah.
It looks really different. I believe it looks
really
different.
And it loses its color.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's dyed or something.
Yeah. But this is called Sea Glass Crafts, 28 Fun Projects You Can Make at Home by C.S. Lambert. As it says in the beginning, if you love sea glass, you are sure to find ideas in this book that will inspire you to incorporate your seaside treasures into your home decor, inside and out, practical and decorative, whimsical and serious. So some of it is just using the beach glass in your garden. And again, this has lots of great photos in it. One of them is creating a sea glass coffee table, so you can essentially have a beach in a box. So you have the sand with the beach glass on top of it. So a lot of them are sort of complicated, I would say, but some of them are really simple, like making an ornament, a holiday ornament out of your sea glass. And one last craft book is Seaside Quilts, Quilting and Sewing Projects for Beach-Inspired Decor. It actually, again, if you're a quilter, this is going to be a great, if you're not a quilter, I don't think this is going to be a great help to you. But if you are a quilter, one of the things it has right at the beginning is sourcing the palette. To set a seaside theme, consider the natural elements and vistas of the seashore for color and texture clues. So they have the colors that would be beach glass. There's colors that would be rocks, glass floats, sand. And then they have great patterns. One of them that I particularly liked was a day at the beach quilt, which was just this beautiful quilt with layers of all the things you might see at the beach. So you've got at the bottom, you've got the sand, and you've got buckets and sand buckets and kites at the top and fish and waves. And it is a really beautiful quilt. So if you're a quilter, take a look at Seaside Quilts.
Yeah. Years ago, with my daughter, we did stepping stones. You know, you get the little thing of cement, you make the square, and we use the sea glass.
You put the sea glass.
That's how
in
I know
it.
The color doesn't last because the lobster we made didn't stay red.
Okay.
What have you got, Peter?
Well, I've always loved reading pirate stories, and that's kind of beachy. I remember when I was a kid, I read a book called Red Pete the Ruthless. And this, I'm reminded of this by the tide line, high tide, low tide. So the book ends with Red Pete, who's this despicable, violent pirate, buried up to his neck between the high and low tide lines with all his treasure arrayed around him. Lovely scene. Anyway, so...
And this is a kid's book, huh?
This was a kid's book, right. So, but what I brought today are two nonfiction books about pirates. The first is The Republic of Pirates by Colin Woodard. And it's basically about the golden age of piracy, which actually in the Caribbean, which was actually a very short period between 1715 and 1725, when a kind of freebooting republic of pirates was established in, on New Providence Island in the Bahamas. And some of the pirates involved, you know, included Black Sam Bellamy, who you, I'm sure, Mindy, you must have done interviews about, Blackbeard and Charles Vane. But there's a lot about, and how it was eventually destroyed, but there's a lot about, you know, who the pirates were. They were mostly disgruntled sailors because the merchant sailors and the Navy sailors in those days were treated awfully. I mean, life was terrible if you were before the mast. And so these were deserters, escaped slaves often, and they lived a kind of anarchistic slash democratic life for this brief period of time. The other book is Under the Black Flag by David Cordingly, and it's much more comprehensive. This is the whole complete history of piracy, you know, from A to Z up into modern times. And he's really great on showing how, what sort of the fiction writers got right about it and what they just totally, like Robert, you know, our idea of what the pirates were like is really from Robert Louis Stevenson and Peter Pan.
That's right. But, that's right.
But this is, and some they did get right. For example, Long John Silver was a cook and he was one-legged. Well, there's an illustration actually, and they're actually, I should say, in this book, they're excellent illustrations. And here is a typical sea cook on one leg, because those mutilated, injured sailors, you know, couldn't really be on deck anymore, but they could still
be cooking.
Cook.
Yeah.
So he was right about that. However, there was no walking the plank.
There was never any
if it happened, it was very rare. They just threw the bodies
just three overboard.
Yes. Why to have that interim
why waste the time on
stage?
Right.
But the well, in those days, the bar just in general society on violence and was set pretty low. Although, why I'm saying we've advanced with every day you wake up, but anyway, let's not go there. So these pirates, although they were horribly bloody, you know, bloodthirsty and cruel, actually fit in well in society, but they had to be wiped out. This book actually presents a different, that part about whether these escaped slaves were now free and whether they'd advance to a society like that. Actually, this other book disputes it. And apparently the pirates themselves had lots of slaves who they bought and sold. But so these are two very good nonfiction books on piracy. But I just want to make one little plug here for the Aubrey Maturin novels written by Patrick O'Brien, because there's piracy in them too. But those are wonderful beach reading. Master and Commander was made into a movie that I don't think quite captured the charm of the series, which is about 20 books long. But I would recommend, if you just wanted to dip into it, the first one, Master and Commander, and the 10th one, The Reverse of the Medal, I think are my two favorites.
866-999-4626 if you'd like to suggest a book with a beach theme. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill.
I've brought along a history book as well, but it's a history book about Cape Cod. It's called Becoming Cape Cod, Creating a Seaside Resort by James C. O'Connell. This was actually published in 2003, and I just picked it up again because of this show. And it is just chock full of information about how we became what we are, a big, big venue for tourists. And he talks about the first tourist on Cape Cod, which would have been Henry David Thoreau. And of course, I'm sure many of you listeners are familiar with Thoreau's Cape Cod. And he begins this book talking about Thoreau, saying he took four walking trips on Cape Cod between 1849 and 1857. He encountered no vacationers. Antebellum Cape Cod was a seafaring area then. It made absolutely no appeal to tourists. The sea was the great reality as a force of nature and as a means of making a living. The Cape's beaches were desolate, its sandy landscape bereft of trees, its shipwrecks haunting, its inhabitants ornery. Thoreau visited the Cape because it was so far off the beaten track. He wrote in Cape Cod, 1865, that the dunescape near Provincetown was, quote, the dreariest scenery imaginable. Well, needless to say, things have changed a lot since then. And he talks about all the various ways this came to be, but puts it all back on Thoreau's shoulders, because once he talked about it, and it's what we've seen actually this year in Falmouth. You know, we were on the Food Network for the town of Falmouth. There were several restaurants featured on the Food Network last spring, or almost a year ago spring. And Believe me, people are aware of that. And so we, I feel, have more tourists than we have ever had. And partially it's because once the word gets out there. So Thoreau put the word out there with his first Cape Cod vacation. And then before you knew it, Putnam's Monthly was publishing something about how great Cape Cod was. Charles Nordoff's 1875 Harper's Monthly article, Cape Cod, Nantucket and the Vineyard, noted that Thoreau's Cape journeys were a notable feat. Samuel Adams Drake's Nooks and Corners of the New England Coast opened its chapter on Cape Cod with a quote from Thoreau. So he became, you know, the go-to guy, and still is in some ways the go-to guy. But in here, there's a great section, which I was particularly interested in living in Falmouth, about Falmouth Heights and how Falmouth Heights began, and about the seaside offering escape from everything else. Just before the completion of the railroad to Falmouth, a group of Worcester investors who were originally intended to develop a vacation resort on Martha's Vineyard established the Cape's first planned resort at Falmouth Heights. And, of course, Falmouth Heights is still going strong. And he talks about why it was the middle class that was coming out to vacation and why what it was that pulled them to the Cape. And he writes, the seaside offered an escape from the muggy, non-air-conditioned cities, seething with unsanitary cesspools, piles of horse manure, and industrial wastes. If your family could afford it, you left the oppressive urban environment. It was important to get children away from the potentially fatal summer diseases, typhoid, diphtheria, and dysentery that haunted 19th century America. Cape Cod often is 10 degrees cooler than Boston, and it enjoys nearly constant ocean breezes. Dips in the cooling Atlantic were a perfect antidote to summer heat, which of course they still are, but the fact that it was the diseases that was pulling people to the beach is also a really interesting bit. One of the great things about this book is also, the fellow that wrote it has a great collection
of postcards. Yeah, I was going to say the postcards.
So the postcard collection in here is fabulous, and you get to see all the old hotels that have since been taken down and put up with something else. He has great images. So it's a very interesting take. It talks a lot about the creation of the national park and why that happened. So if you really want sort of an overview and not, you know, too weighty, he has some fun things in here as well. Try taking a look at Becoming Cape Cod by James C. O'Connell. I wish he'd do an update.
I know. I think, wasn't there something in there, too, about the premiere of Wizard of Oz? Was it Wizard of Oz or Gone with the Wind? One of those that like premiered here in a theater on the Cape?
I'm not sure.
I think it could have been. Dan says it was Wizard of Oz. Okay. See, Dan, he knows everything. I'm telling you. He should go on Jeopardy or whatever.
Yes, let's have Dan on Jeopardy. That's a great idea.
What's your next book, Peter?
I wonder whether in Thoreau's time the beaches were even in the same place.
Oh, right.
Our beaches here on Cape Cod. Anyway, back in the water. For me, the beach has always been, you know, the entryway to the water. I love being on the beach, but I don't like just lying there. I like to heat up, get in the water. So what I brought, this book is called Deep. It's by James Nestor. And it's really all about what happens at various levels of the ocean. But the main thing it's about is free diving. Do you know about free diving?
No, I don't.
So free diving is breath hold diving.
Oh, okay.
And I guess you could call it a sport. And there are competitions. In fact, one of the big places for competitions is at a place called Dean's Blue Hole, which is in the Bahamas on Long Island, just a small island down there. And it's one of these blue holes they have in the Bahamas. I've dived in some of them, but not this particular one. And it's right off the beach. on this on Long Island, and it from above it looks like the ocean is kind of, you know, that turquoise. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking from above, the Blue Hole, it's like a round, deep sapphire blue. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, so the surrounding bottom is maybe 20 feet, 10 feet. It's 600 feet deep.
Wow.
In there. So there are number, these are the same as the cenotes in Central America. So it's become a free diving mecca, and where they have competitions. The depths that are now being attained, there are many different variations of the sport. Some involve using a weight to get you down. Some involve being allowed to pull on the line. But some are just mask, fins, and snorkel. And that's the one that interests me. There have been advances in how to hold your all of this guy, James Nestor, the writer, went through a course on everything. So he learned how to hold your breath for a longer time, how to be more efficient in your movements, all the kinds of ways they're doing free diving. The record now for the kind of free diving that I'm talking about with mask, fin, snorkel is close, I believe it's now almost 400 feet.
Wow.
Okay, which is an astonishing,
that's amazing
depth. You're reaching depths with free diving that actually scuba divers can't do.
Seems impossible,
yes,
doesn't
because
it?
Well,
it's and isn't too, it wildly it's, dangerous?
Okay,
to do
well,
this?
Let's get to the danger. Because so I did. When I was as a kid in the summers, not a kid, but, you know, a college kid, I worked as a spear fisherman in the Bahamas, and that was all breath hold diving because scuba spearing was illegal because there's not much sport in it. You go lie on the bottom and wait for a grouper to come and kill it. But if you're holding your breath, you know, there's a time limit on what you can do. So, yes, it is very dangerous. The most I ever did was maybe like 80 feet. And I used to think, wow, that's pretty good. It's just nothing compared to what these people, men and women, by the way, mm-hmm. are doing now. But yes, it's very dangerous. There are physiological things that happen. There's something called shallow water blackout. Mm. And well, let me just tell you about this Dean's Blue Hole. I hadn't been, my brother was there. One of my brothers, also a diver, was there recently. And I said, oh, you were there. And he said, it's just incredibly fantastic and beautiful. But something that catches your attention is all around the Blue Hole are memorials to the people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, who've died. But this book, these competitions are of no interest to me whatsoever, because I think it misses the whole, and this writer, James Nestor, he makes this point, and I think it's an excellent point, that the beauty of this is not the competition where you're zoned out and you're just trying to, you know, you're blocking
out
everything.
Break a record, yeah.
It's actually to be part of the sea. And that's the great appeal of it. When you're even, I think most people could learn even to go to 30 or 40 feet, where you see all kinds of life anyway, mm-hmm. you know, here on Cape Cod. You wouldn't want to go much deeper, but you get this feeling that you're part of things mm-hmm. when you don't have all this equipment. It's just you, and there's a wonderful kind of, I hate to say it, but natural high that accompanies this. So I recommend
a meditative thing.
Yes,
I mean,
it is a meditative thing.
I've snorkeled, but I haven't gone
down
40 feet.
No, there is a meditative thing, absolutely, that comes. And deep tells you everything you'd want to know about
that. All right.
Free diving.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books with a beach theme with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Joan writes, I enthusiastically urge folks to read the Patrick O'Brien books, especially young adults. You learn so much about history and friendship and sea life. Great stuff. Thank you, Joan in Chatham. And let's see, we have Christina here who says, Cy Montgomery, author of Great White Shark Scientists, will be speaking at the CVU in Dennisport this Friday, July 29th, 1 p.m. The event is sponsored by the Friends of Dennis Public Library, so you might want to check that out. Jill, what's your next book?
Well, I thought I'd bring some just regular old short stories, right? And I found this book on the shelf in the library called The Beach Book. And it's a collection, indeed, of short stories. And I started looking at it one of the things that's unique about it is that it is waterproof. The publisher actually created the book so that you can, you know, bring it to the beach, literally, and it can get wet and it's not going to hurt anybody.
That's a flaw with my shark book.
That's right.
Because if you're out there, you want to pull it from your pocket and see
it's
where you're going to live or die.
No. You want to get to the beach before you're going to look at that.
So I read a review of this in the New York Times, which is actually really sort of funny because it starts on the theory that people who vacation at the ocean's edge want to read about others in similar circumstances. The editors of this anthology have collected 10 evocative stories that unfold in the watery idols of the world. As an added enticement for seaside readers, the publisher has even manufactured the pages by a copyrighted process guaranteed to make them waterproof, the book as rubber beach toy. Just don't wade in expecting escapist summer fare, which I have to say is what I would have expected from this book. The blue waters and tropical breezes offer more danger than pleasure in these stories. There is a hurricane, a drowning, and a venomous snail. The poison may represent a miracle cure for malaria if it doesn't drop you stone dead. Characters succumb to AIDS, shark attacks, murderous drug dealers, and amoebic dysentery. So, you know, not necessarily a fun beach read. However, there are, in fact, some beautifully written stories in here. And the first one is The Shell Collector by Anthony Doerr. And for those of you that absolutely loved All the Light We Cannot See, which is still, I think there's still holds on that in the library, written by Anthony Doerr. He also wrote a group of short stories, and it is called The Shell Collector, and the first story in that collection is also in this book. So you've got both sort of classic writers. You've got Gabriel Garcia Marquez in here. You've got Roald Dahl, but then you've got people like Anthony Doerr. So both living and dead writers and a good beach read collection of short stories.
All right, let's talk to Keith, who's giving us a call from Truro. Hi, Keith.
Hi.
Hi.
The book I like this summertime is this thing called The Seaside Naturalist, a guide to study at the seashore. Hmm. And it's written and illustrated by a woman named Deborah A. Colom. I'll spell that name. It's C-O-U-L-O-M-E-E. And it's like a 9x11 format book, paperback, moderately priced. And what she does all these wonderful essays, short introductions to all the different kinds of life forms that you'd likely encounter in an ocean. She has a survey of the life of the ocean, and then she does marine plants and marine protozoa. And it goes on to sponges and comb jellies and, you know, all the things out there, arthropods, mollusks, birds. And the great thing about it is none of it's too technical.
Yeah. Keith, is it just the seaside?
Anywhere.
Yeah, Keith, is it seaside here or is it all beaches? I mean, is it like a Florida kind of?
It's really salt beaches. So she makes references to things down on the Gulf Coast and on southern beaches like in North Carolina, et cetera. But the thing about it is that the life forms she's talking about are so ubiquitous that it's very easily applied to wherever you happen to be standing.
Okay.
And so I got it at either the Visitor Center in Eastham of the National Seashore or at the Wellfleet Audubon Society. I mean, it's a naturalist type book.
Yeah.
But it's friendly to read.
Great. Well, that's important, Keith. Thanks for that suggestion, The Seaside Naturalist. We'll definitely put that on our list. And for folks who are trying to keep track, don't worry. We will have a link later today to all of the books we talk about in case you missed a title or something. And what's your next book, Peter?
Oh, well, first of all, I have to back up to the sandcastles because I forgot to mention she's very good on where to find the best sand. And the Gulf Coast was just mentioned by the caller, or you, Mindy. Yeah. And Gulf Coast sand is superb for building sandcastles.
Good to know.
Anyway, I brought two books on long-distance swimming. The first is called Swimming to Antarctica by Lynn Cox. You might remember her. She also swam in the Bering Sea. She's this champion swimmer. She broke the men's and women's English Channel records. She swam in Antarctica for a mile in 32-degree water with no wetsuit.
Wow.
She credits her plump figure. that she says it works for her. Anyway, this is a very well-written book and just something that these are very, very special people. And she also was the first person to swim across the Straits of Magellan. So can I read just a very small?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
This gives you an idea. So the Straits of Magellan, first person, not too many people probably want to, right?
Right.
But here she is in the Straits of Magellan. I look back again. There were bigger gray clouds, and Tierra del Fuego was sliding by to my right. The tide had changed. It was flowing from the west toward the Atlantic, and it was building quickly, like a hose bent and suddenly released. The force was incredible. We were flying sideways to the west at 3, maybe 4 knots. Now the waves and tidal current were in complete opposition, slamming into each other and rising up like small tsunamis. Swimming was very difficult. There was no rhythm to the sea. Turning to breathe, I drew in water. It flew up my nose and down my throat. Choking, lifting my head to get air, I looked across the sea and it was chaos. Green white caps darkening to a threatening gray, and the wind sweeping across the water in 40-knot gust showered us with frothy spray.
Wow.
So this takes someone very special to be swimming the Straits of Magellan. So I recommend that book highly by Lynn Cox. And the other book these are both autobiographical. Mm-hmm. This is Diana Nyad's book called Find a Way. And I think we all know Diana Nyad, first to swim from Cuba to Key West in 2013. It's 111 miles and she did it in 53 hours, which involves staying awake for 53. So let's say I just was told, okay, stay awake for 53 hours.
And like, you don't have to swim.
Sitting,
just stay awake.
Lying around the house, I couldn't come close. Maybe even 24 would be a challenge. So she's just this incredible athlete. And this book also has great photos of her. Oh, there are photos that include close-ups of third-degree burns on her body from ocean chafing.
Wow.
And, of course, the jellyfish that tormented her on all these swims until they finally figured out this sort of facial mask that she wore. But it involved, she had to learn to get her head much further out of the water every time she breathed to do it. Can you imagine? Just you've been swimming for 60 years and now you're learning a new way to do your head. She's an incredible person. And it's all about her training too. And she has a whole playlist of songs in her mind that she goes over and over. There are 85 of them.
Wow.
And someone discovered that they were all in 4/4 time.
Mm.
And so it's that rhythm, I guess, that she likes. So it's called Find a Way by Diana Nyad.
Right. Jonathan gave us a suggestion. He says The Enduring Shore, A History of Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket by Paul Schneider. I love Paul Schneider's work. He's a wonderful writer. So, yeah, any of his books are great. But that's a great suggestion, Jonathan. Thanks for that. And John says, look into The Blue Eye Scallop. That doesn't have the author, but The Blue Eye Scallop. I'm not sure what that is. That's all we have on that one. 866-999-4626 or thepoint at capeandislands.org. Jill, what's your next book?
I've brought a book, a history sort of, and a meditation on seashells. It's called Spirals in Time, The Secret Life and Curious Afterlife of Seashells by Helen Scales. And it is a book that takes this single subject and finds doors to open in all directions, as the review says. It begins with Triton, the merman of Greek mythology, with his seashell trumpet. Scales then describes the shells she found on childhood holidays. Broken ones fascinated her especially. In her paintings, she tried repeatedly to catch the delicate colors of mussels. She learns to dive. She goes on adventuring onto reefs and shipwrecks. And she ends up becoming a marine biologist. And she talks a lot about the various aspects of shells. And so one of the curious things about this book is all the little facts you pick up along the way. So, for example, you can learn in this book where the oldest shell collection is. And she writes, one of the strongest connections many people feel to seashells is the urge now and then collect them. One of the oldest known shell collections was preserved in the Roman city of Pompeii.
Wow.
When Mount Vesuvius erupted in 79 AD, it it choked and buried the city and its inhabitants in ash. Inside one excavated house, archaeologists found a gathering of shells that came from distances, certainly as far as the Red Sea, and they seem to have been kept for one simple reason, that they looked pretty.
Wow.
So you get little facts like that. And she also has a whole section on buying shells and why you may not want to be buying shells, because often they, if they're perfect, it's because there was a living animal in it and somebody killed the animal in order to make it happen that they could sell it.
That's a good point. So, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. Yes. So you learn things like that. And she has every different aspect of shells you can imagine. It's called Spirals in Time, The Secret Life and Curious Afterlife of Seashells by Helen Scales. A little on the academic side, but still full of interesting facts.
It's way more fun to go find your own shells anyway.
Yeah, this is true.
Peter, what have you got?
I've got two books on surfing. The first is a nonfiction book, The World in the Curl. It's by Peter Westwick and Peter Neuschel. And this is the whole history of surfing from the beginning to now. So everything is in here. Surf forecasting, board design, Gidget, Dick Dale. It's all in this book, the invention of wetsuits and how that changed everything. There are many things in here that are just fascinating that I didn't realize. One of the things that had to happen in California for surfing really to take off was they had to get the oil rigs off the beach. Up until the 30s, oil rigs on like Huntington Beach, places like that, the oil rigs were right there. And it's the book is excellent on how, you know, this is kind of Hawaii's gift to the world, or at least one of them. And just how intertwined surfing and the Hawaiian culture were, and how important it was to them, and how it's almost like their religious beliefs are still, when you surf, you're still being part of that. And all this stuff about how Hawaii really was this paradise, where because these people, the Hawaiians were probably the best nourished people on earth. They were just living in this garden. They had all this seafood and everything grew. They didn't have to work too hard. They had a 3-month surfing festival where everybody stopped working for the year, and they were all in great shape because they loved, everybody surfed. So when you're out there, you're paddling. Incidentally, they invented the freestyle by doing that. So World in the Curl is the nonfiction. And then this is Barbarian Days by William Finnegan. It's the best written book that I brought in here today, and it's kind of a surfing memoir. He grew up partly in Hawaii, and the book is about, it's his whole, he became a writer, but it's how surfing was a huge part of his life, and he surfed all over the world. So I highly recommend it.
We got it's Stalking the Blue-Eyed Scallop by Yul Gibbons, who tells us how to find marvelous food in every coastal area of North America. Less than a minute, Jill.
Well, for those of you that just want to know where all the good beaches are, you could try Beachcomber's Guide to the Northeast by Dan Tobin. It has all kinds of beach information and where they are from all over New England. And so you can also see what the best sandy beach is, what the best beach is for shells. It talks about all kinds of shells. It talks about shipwrecks. It talks about beach glass. It's sort of the one and all book on beaches. It tells you where shipwrecks are, where you might find things, where you might find sea glass and pottery shards. It talks about the drift line. It talks about beach creatures, and then does have a whole listing of the beaches from Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine, and gives information such as what the daily parking fee is, or if there's a daily parking
or
fee.
A space.
They need to update that book every
year.
If
you need a beach sticker, and it has just come out. So I think that a lot of people who happen to be in town will
might
really enjoy Beachcomber's Guide to the Northeast.
All right. And again, we'll have a link up later today on our website, capeandislands.org, for the books that we talked about today. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Author Peter Abrahams, who also writes the Chet and Bernie series. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.